welcome to all of you for this important conference. As some of the program materials suggest, following Jefferson's vision of the university's public service mission, the Miller Center of Public Affairs is a leading public policy institution that serves as a meeting place where engaged citizens, scholars, journalists, government officials, and others can meet to engage in great discussions about the issues of our time. We engage in issues that permit us to research, reflect, and report on issues of national importance to the governance of this country. We put particular focus on the central role and history of the American presidency. The center pursues its mission through academic and research programs, through public forums and conferences, through the creation of national commissions, and other reports that are issued from time to time. I might mention to you that earlier this year, the Miller Center announced the creation of its National Commission on the War Powers of the President and the Congress. It is co-chaired by former Secretaries of State James Baker and Warren Christopher. You might be interested to know about some of the other members of that commission. Let me read you the names. Slade Gordon, former senator from the state of Washington. Lee Hamilton, director of the Woodrow Wilson International Center and former congressman. Carla Hills, former U.S. trade representative. Jack Marsh, former Secretary of the Army. Ed Meese, former Attorney General of the United States. Abner Mikva, former judge of the U.S. Court of the Circuit Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia and former White House counsel. Four-star Admiral Paul Reason, commander-in-chief, former commander-in-chief of the U.S. Atlantic Fleet. Brent Scowcroft, former National Security Advisor. Anne Marie Slaughter, dean of the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton. Strobe Talbot, former, currently president of the Brookings Institution and former Deputy Secretary of State. Ex officio members include the president of the University of Virginia, John Castine, and David Liebrand, who is president of Rice. This commission is looking at some of the great unresolved questions about war and peace that have been unresolved during the 200-plus years of the history of this country. Its report is expected to be released sometime next spring. Earlier this year, we also announced the creation of a national discussion and debate series, a focus on our part to deal with the growing dismay in this country over the absence of informed, rational discussion, a world in which we are seemingly preoccupied with sound bites and slogans as answers to the questions of importance to the governance of this country. We intend to put on the floor two teams of debaters who will engage in some of our discussions. We will select the topics. We're in the process of doing that now. We will put on our website extensive research materials for the use of the debaters, as well as for government officials, journalists, and including every classroom teacher and student in the country. Earlier this week, we announced the formation of a partnership with McNeil Lehrer Productions to produce these debates. The first one will be scheduled for September the 18th at the Rotunda here at the University of Virginia. Today, the Miller Center is pleased and proud to present another important conference, this one on the role of America's future in the world. Today and tomorrow, we will have assembled here at the Miller Center some of the nation's leading thinkers about issues, about dilemmas, about trade-offs that should be the focus of our discussion about America's future in shaping its foreign policy. I am pleased, particularly, that all of you are gathered here today, but I'm especially appreciative of the efforts of two distinguished faculty members who are leading another Miller Center initiative. known as GAGE, the acronym for Governing America in a Global Era. Those two co-chairs are Professors Mel Leffler and Jeff LeGros. They are distinguished in their own right, but they are appropriate to lead this discussion today and tomorrow. And I'm glad to bring back to the microphone Jeff LeGros to introduce the program.
Thank you very much, Governor. My name is Jeff LeGros, and I'm a professor in the Department of Politics here and one of the co-directors of the GAGE program. GAGE is actually an effort that joins together the study of America and the world, something that Mel Leffler and I are doing, with the study of domestic politics, a program that has been going on here under the title of American Political Development, led by Sid Milkus and Brian Ballow. We're trying to cross two divides. One is the traditional divide between foreign policy and domestic politics. We want to look at not only the domestic roots of America's role in the world, but how the world is shaping America as well. And we're trying to bring together scholars, typical academics, with the types of people that are roomed in the room today, public intellectuals, outstanding journalists and commentators, people who are engaged in civic debates. The conference represents this, our After the Bush Doctrine, National Security Strategy and the Next Administration, speaks to exactly these issues. And Mel and I are delighted that you're all here today. Leading international scholars, public intellectuals, superb journalists and analysts, UVA professors, Miller Center experts, and of course our engaged community leaders and activists. Thank you for coming. I'd also like to thank a few people who have helped make the conference happen. First and foremost, Governor Bliles, for your support for the program. I'd like to thank our excellent Miller Center colleagues here, many of whom have put a lot of time into this conference. Thank you for your efforts. Like to thank the friends in the community who have offered us a lot of good advice and a lot of financial support. We very much appreciate it. I'd like to thank Susan Ferber from Oxford University Press, who is with us and who will be editing the volume that will come out of this conference. And finally, and most importantly, I'd like to thank the person who most of you have communicated with at length over many months, and that is Ann Mulligan, who has made all of this happen. Ann Mulligan joined the Miller Center last September, and she's just done a phenomenal job on this conference and been helped in that by Chi Lam, who helped us in the initial stages of this project. And we're very grateful to her. I'd like to ask my colleague, Mel Leffler, to come up and set the stage for the talks over the next day and a half.
Thanks, Jeff. It's a great pleasure for me to be here and to welcome all of you. It's really a fantastic opportunity for us at the Miller Center and at the university to have a group of people such as we have around this table. And we've given them a truly formidable assignment in terms of trying to basically write a national security paper for the next administration of the United States. We've asked each one to take on a very challenging set of questions. So we've asked each person, in effect, to identify the greatest threats facing the United States. We've asked them to try to identify the most vital interests of the United States. We've asked them to seek to assign priorities between competing goals, domestic, foreign. We've asked them to think about the role of human rights and democracy in the nation's foreign policy. And we've invited them to think systematically about the trade-offs between values, and interests. We've asked them to examine the extent to which multilateral institutions, international institutions, and multilateral strategies should play a decisive role in the formulation of American national security policy. Basically, we wanted our contributors to think thoughtfully about how is it possible for the United States both to ensure its own security at home while enhancing its reputation around the world. Now, we know that these matters are immensely serious. They are immensely complex issues with intersecting variables and competing trade-offs. We know that these matters cannot be addressed in a two-minute soundbite. In fact, we've asked each contributor around the table to write a 10,000-word essay. To my immense pleasure, everyone submitted this essay in advance. They are a terrific set of essays and draft essays, and we have circulated them to one another and to the commentators. And what we will do at the sessions today is to ask each of the commentators, for example, at this first session, Fareed Zakaria will start with a 10 to 15 minute comment on the three or four papers under scrutiny at this session. We will then ask each of the paper writers to respond or to reaffirm key points of their papers, and we've asked them to limit their remarks to 5 minutes. We're then going to throw open the discussion to everyone sitting around the table, and we've also asked for each session at least one specific person to comment in particular on each essay, and that hopefully will simply emerge organically as a result of the conversation that arises. And then for the last 15 or 20 minutes of the of each session, which will take 2 hours, sessions are for 2 hours, we'll open the floor to questions from people sitting in the audience here. So that's the way we framed it. We are incredibly lucky to have such diverse people at this meeting and contributing to the volume that we are designing. We have, in a very rare way, we have sitting around this table economists, historians, political scientists, and public intellectuals. In a very unusual way, we have people sitting around this table who are sometimes associated with the political right, the political center, the political left. But we're also very lucky to have every person sitting around this table who is well known for his or her willingness to ponder alternative views and to re-examine one's own views in light of serious discussion. And that's what we want to have here today and tomorrow. We've organized this conference so that there would not be long presentations of ideas and that are already written in the paper, but we really wanted to have pointed discussion and real dialogue, and we've organized our sessions accordingly. So with this first session, Fareed Zakaria is going to moderate the session. As many of you know, Fareed is the author of many books, most recently The Future of Freedom. He's also the international editor of Newsweek magazine, in which I think in the last issue a long essay appeared on foreign policy after Bush. and Fareed will moderate. And then we have four papers that we will discuss at the session. Bob Kagan, who's a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment of International Peace, and has just published a history of American foreign policy called Dangerous Nation, and he's also the author of many other books, will be responding to Fareed's comments. And we have David Kennedy, who's the Pulitzer Prize winning author of Freedom from Fear, The American People During the Great Depression and World War II, and a professor of history at Stanford, will be responding to Fareed's comments. Samantha Power, who's a professor of public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School, and the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, A Problem from Hell, America in the Age of Genocide, is also one of our panelists today. And finally, James Kurth, a professor of political science at Swarthmore and the editor of the influential journal Orbis. So that's how this first session will shape up. And Fareed, I'll now hand it over to you. And we have a red card here, like in world soccer, to make sure everybody complies with the 15-minute or 5-minute time constraint. Thanks so much.
Do I get the red card, are you going to wave it at me? Exactly. No, the beauty of being the timekeeper is that I will. You have to trust me to observe my own time limit.
Although I have one alternative.
Jump in. Trust but verify. Okay, what I thought I would do is first try to set the ground rules in the sense of urging everyone to try and approach this as informally and candidly as we can. No long speeches. Let's just try and have as vigorous and direct a discussion as we can. The papers are here. People can have access to them. And so I would urge us to move in that direction. What I thought I'd do is I've read the four drafts that were sent to me. And let me just try to characterize, let me try and make some observations, not so much about the drafts themselves, but about the nature of the questions they've been trying to ask implicitly or explicitly, and leave it to the paper writers to decide how much of this they want to respond to. Neil, you already have a point of order.
I do. I want to be clear about whether we're operating under what I would call Chatham-Hurst rules, or whether what we say can be publicly quoted.
Neil, it's all being recorded and televised.
Okay.
The state secrets will have to be told in secret. This follows the principle, I think, which is that Chatham-Hurst rules are rather bizarre, since for the most part, intellectuals, journalists, academics are desperately hoping to be quoted. And so the idea that, there would be any real advantage in not quoting people has always eluded me. But in any event, I think that all these papers revolve around the same set of issues. But the first one I would characterize as a surprising disagreement, which is, was Bush a break? Was Bush a break from the past? And this is something that comes up most directly in Robert Kagan's paper. Kagan makes the argument that Bush was in fact part of a long tradition of American foreign policy that has been revolutionary and Wilsonian in some fashion or the other. And that Bush in this sense is part of the apostolic succession of American presidents who have pushed these kinds of ideas and methods, unilateralism, preemption, and such. And my only wonder about that would be, I suppose one way of putting it would be, if that's true, isn't everybody else in the world wrong, Robert Kagan? In other words, it seems as though Bush's foreign policy has provoked a kind of rare consensus among almost every student of American foreign policy, both here and abroad, who seems to believe that Bush's foreign policy represents a fairly strong, sharp break from other presidents and has had consequences that, and as a result has been, by and large, condemned. What adds to the puzzle here is that Bush, his supporters and many people in the Bush administration, when they were enunciating these policies, took great pride in the fact that they saw themselves as sharply breaking from the past. This was something that was repeated time and time again by Bush administration officials. I haven't done research for this, but I think one could pull up eloquent editorials in the Weekly Standard that would have made that case, and that, in fact, what was commendable about Bush was precisely that he had diverged from the hapless Clinton era and the perfidious Bush I era of either, you know, taking a holiday from history or coddling dictators and managing stability. All of a sudden now, therefore, it's a puzzle to see the same people who applauded Bush for this radical break with history to be told everybody else has been doing this all along. Bush, like the man in the bourgeois gentilhomme, has been speaking prose his whole life without even realizing it. So my question, I suppose, if there was a question, and I'll try and raise one to every paper writer, would be, are you the only honest man in Washington, Robert
Kagan?
That's
easy. That's a harder question than that.
Well, especially since you're in Brussels these days. The second general theme that I think that these papers suggest is that there is some disagreement about what the fundamental nature of the world we are in is. And I know that sounds very grand, but what I mean by that is, quite simply, are we in a unipolar world? Is the unipolar moment turned into an era? And again, I think that there are some papers, and certainly Bob's, that seems to suggest that. Samantha Powers argues, on the other hand, that U.S. influence is on the wane. There are tectonic shifts that are changing the nature of international politics, and all of which suggests a very different picture. James Kurth argues that, if you will, rising disorder is the kind of fundamental characteristic of the age we're in. And it seems to me that that's something that is worth discussing, because a great deal follows from the question of what kind of world we're living in. You can certainly look at the statistics and make almost any case you want. The United States spends more on defense than the rest of the world put together. It remains the single largest economy in the world. And yet, if you regard that as a snapshot, if you were to take a moving picture, the trend lines are, in a sense, at some fundamental level, moving away from American dominance. The relative strength of the U.S. economy as a percentage of the world has probably peaked. It's inconceivable that you will have a situation 20 years from now where the United States has the same share of world GDP. It already is falling if you look at this in purchasing power parity terms. In other words, if you take 1980 as a baseline and say real GDP, U.S. was 20% in 1980, it's 29% now. A very significant part of that has to do with the strength of the dollar. If you look at purchasing power numbers, the U.S. was 20% of world GDP in 1980, it is 20% now and falling. And that is, of course, the rise of China and India and Brazil and South Africa and the rest. But the other aspect of this world is just how diffuse has power become, how manageable is it? And James Kurth makes the argument that we're almost entering a kind of new Middle Ages, where you have the problem of disorder as the primary problem that countries will face, largely within their borders, but that problem of disorder within borders will spill outside. And if that is the case, then it suggests, you know, something completely different in terms of what we should do about it. Third question I would raise is, what is the principal threat then? Samantha Powers makes the case that the war on terror is a rubric that should be dispensed with. And this has now honestly become a familiar argument among some Democratic strategists. John Edwards says this in his in a speech he recently gave. Others have said the same thing. Samantha says it more eloquently and sharply. But the question I would ask is, what would one then replace it with? What is the principal threat to American interests, to the United States, in the world today? Is it the rise of China, which still seems a somewhat distant prospect in the political, military, sense of the word? There aren't a lot of Chinese soldiers trying to kill Americans. Something Bob Kagan refers to when he talks about a kind of competitive multipolarity rubric of a unipolar world. How dangerous is that to the United States, that you have these other great powers jostling for influence? It does feel to me like it would be worth figuring out whether we do believe, or whether there can be some agreement, that the principal threat to American interests, values, and ideas is, in fact, radical militant Islam. And yet, the war on terror may not be the most appropriate rubric or organizing framework. And why would one come to those two separate conclusions? And how would one then organize American foreign policy? What would be the rubric if you were to come to that conclusion, as I will show my hand, as that's certainly how I would look at it. Radical jihadists are the only coherent organized movement that is trying to kill Americans, thwart American interests, and oppose American ideas and ideals in any concentrated way around the world. And yet, I'm not sure that the war on terror is an appropriate framework in terms of which to analyze the future. The final question I suppose I would ask is, the question I should have asked Jim Kurth was regarding the order of the nature of the world, which is this problem of domestic disorder one that you would organize foreign policy around? In other words, what about the traditional national security challenges? You begin your paper by saying we should really dispense with this business of promoting democracy and try to promote order instead. Would you be trying to promote order at the level of international relations, or delve deeper and actually try to stabilize these countries all over the world, which strikes me as a very tall order in a world in which almost every trend is moving toward a greater degree of disorder? You know, the ability of governments to control the flow of people, goods, money, guns, drugs seems to be declining. And at that very moment, to make the principal focus of American foreign policy the ability to order that seems, as I say, a tall order. The last question, the fourth question I would ask, is a simple one, which is Lenin's old question, what is to be done? So if we have some sense of what the nature of the world is, what the principal threats are, what would we do about them? There's all kinds of suggestions. Some people have more specific ones. Samantha actually is commendably precise on this, and she would first apologize to the world for George Bush, but we have to agree, decide on whether or not he was a break from the past, close Guantanamo, and there's a series of very specific recommendations. Others remain somewhat vague. David Kennedy, for example, has a suggestion that we do something about the very strange civil-military relations we're in because of the nature of the all-volunteer force and broader technological and demographic developments he talks about, which are all very true, and raises the question of how military force will be wielded to get things done in this new era. So he talks about the reality that not only does the United States spend more than the rest of the world put together on defense, but that the American military budget is surprisingly affordable. It is 4% of GDP now. It has ranged from 6 to 15% at various points during the Cold War. The way I would put this is, when the denominator gets very, very large. All these numbers suddenly become don't seem that big on a $12.5 trillion economy. All of a sudden, these numbers don't seem that large. I've often been in situations at talks and things where people will get up and ask, how can we possibly afford the Iraq war? Isn't it going to bankrupt the government? And the embarrassing and inconvenient for them, for the person often who is an anti-war person, is that no, in fact, it is, at least in terms of treasure, surprisingly affordable. If you have, if you continue to grow at a $12 trillion economy at 3% a year, it will continue to be surprisingly affordable at the level of as I say, money, not the lives of the people involved, of course. But David Kennedy then suggests that what we need is an exit from this this entire world of civil-military relations, and he talks about the way in which it is turning the United States into a rogue nation. And so my question to him is, if you really feel that strongly about this, what is the exit strategy? It can't simply be to move from a volunteer force to a lottery system. There has to be something larger that the United States should be doing in the world. And I suppose that would be the point in which I think everyone, with the exception of Samantha, could be a little bit more specific. What should the United States do in the next 5 years, in the next 10 years, to change the course or build on it, if you commend it? How can the United States best protect its interests and its ideas? And I will point out in what I hope is a precedent that I have come in well under my time limit. So why don't we go in any particular order? Bob, you want to start us off?
Well, sure. And I don't envy the task of trying to summarize all these papers, which will be hard enough to summarize one of them. And I think you got us off to a good start. I mean, you're exercised about the first 600 words of my 10,000-word paper, so I don't want to spend too much time going through the...
Do you want to disavow them?
No, I think I'll stick by them. I mean, you said you didn't do much research to find out whether what you were saying was true, and all I can say is you would have a hard time going back and finding me saying that Bush was a revolutionary break from the past. I might have applauded the different approach that he was taking to certain problems. And there is a difference between, fundamental sort of grand doctrine and what you choose to do within that doctrine. And not only do I believe that there's continuity, I just wrote a book saying that the continuity goes back 200 years, not just 50 years. So it would have been odd for me to make that point at the time. And the truth is, I really find that, I understand why a lot of people feel this way, but it's you can look at look at basic issues. Fortunately, I'm not alone in thinking that there's continuity. I have the very distinguished Mel Leffler here, who wrote a very fine article about how preemption was not a novel doctrine for American foreign policy. John Lewis Gaddis, who's another person who knows a thing or two about American history, has pointed out that there's tremendous continuity in the American approach. And, when I have sat down with Clinton officials in moments of honesty under Chatham House rules, Neil, they are willing to acknowledge that, their doctrinal approach towards Saddam was no different than the Bush administration's. It's just that just as they didn't want to send ground troops to Kosovo, they didn't want to send ground troops to Iraq, which turns out to be perhaps a very excellent decision, but it is not a doctrinal decision. And I think that's the key point.
And to launch an unprovoked preemptive invasion of a country and occupy it versus not doing so is not a significant difference in foreign policy.
Okay, you're really going to force me to go through all this. So in 1989, the first Bush administration, allegedly a realist administration, invaded and occupied a country in an unprovoked fashion, largely on, by the way, humanitarian and liberal regime change grounds, and that was Panama, launched a humanitarian intervention in Somalia. We can skip the Persian Gulf War, but the Clinton administration launched several unprovoked wars, including the intervention in the sovereign country in the Kosovo conflict. The United States intervened with significant force roughly 9 times over the course of the first 15 years after the Cold War for a variety of reasons, very few of which, by the way, had anything to do with a direct threat to the United States. So, to me, you have to be you have to be a deep intellectual to think that there is a huge deviation in American foreign policy in this period. If you're just a dummy and you look at American behavior since 1989, you see people intervening, the United States intervening once every 20 months or so for a whole variety of reasons. But, you know, if you really want, do you want to continue on this one?
Well, I only have
5 minutes. So
I just want to ask, why is it that all the dummies of the world, not the deep intellectuals, seem to be so exercised about... But why have Bush's actions caused such a reaction, so much greater than one than
well, that is
Clinton's?
There's a complicated answer to that question, Fareed. I mean, you know, if you want to know, for instance, when Russia and China decided that America was a problem, a big problem, it wasn't after 2001. It was in the 1990s, and I would say the turning point war for them was Kosovo. That's when the Chinese decided that we were out of control. That's when, needless to say, the Russians did. So if you want to know who officially turned against American hegemonism in the 1990s, it was Russia and China. The idea that America was getting too big for its britches and was in fact becoming an arrogant and dangerous power was a staple of public intellectual and foreign policy experts' arguments beginning after 1989. You probably remember the book by Bob Tucker and David Hendrickson, The Imperial Temptation, which was a condemnation of Bush's, in their view, unwarranted invasion war in Iraq. Sam Huntington very famously wrote an article in Foreign Affairs called The Lonely Superpower, in which he denigrated American arrogance and hegemonism. And that's an article I think was published in 1998 or 99. You probably published it yourself. Noam Chomsky, I think, has been making this point since before January 21st, 2001. And so I just think there's a certain...
Since 1908.
Well, probably. And so, you know, I think that there is an understandable... People are very upset about the Iraq War, but what I find sort of odd about it is that people were very upset about the Vietnamese War, but no one at the time made an argument that Lyndon Johnson or Nixon had sort of created a revolution in American foreign policy. It's an unnecessary explanation. And to my mind, it's an evasion of a more difficult problem. The more difficult problem is that this is much more characteristic of America than not. And if you have a problem with it, we should get a smarter president, we should get a better president, we should avoid terrible disasters. I have a doctrine of avoiding terrible disasters. But in terms of the overall approach of American foreign policy, the same kinds of foreign policy approach that gets you into Panama, that gets you into Kosovo, that gets you into Haiti, this sense that America has a role to play to do good or even to pursue the ultimate good, as Barack Obama has said, sometimes unilaterally, as the Clinton administration did, as the first Bush administration did, if you can avoid it, that's nice. Sometimes preemptively, in the sense that you are not waiting for Noriega to do anything particularly directly to American interests, but you decided that he's a risk and also an odious fellow, and so you have to get rid of him. I mean, these are consistent trends, consistent patterns of behavior. They mark the Cold War. They marked American behavior in the 19th century at various different times. So, you know, maybe we should confront the more systemic problem here, and instead of, you know, you would have to assume that it's the minute that Bush leaves, we're just no longer going to be like this. But even as I look at the political statements in an allegedly tempestuous political year, I don't see an alternative doctrine coming from, even though I think they think they're writing alternative doctrines, I still see, I mean, we read Barack Obama's speech. He says we need to use force, we may need to use force, and unilaterally if necessary, that we need to, that our security is tied to the security of every other individual in the world. I mean, these are classic American statements. They were redolent. John Kennedy's voice could be heard throughout the Obama speech. So I just don't see this great break. Now I've gone way over my 5 minutes and didn't get to talk about the other 9,400 words in my pen, but that's okay. I can live with that.
Do you want to say something else? You have.
Well, I don't want to violate my.
Samantha, you want to just first address this issue? Is Bush a break? Do you are you convinced?
I'm with Kagan. I'm with Kagan on this one. I think that the Democratic establishment is too quick to cite such differences as. We in the Clinton era were multilateral when we can, unilateral when we must, And the Bush administration is unilateral when it can. It's his first impulse, and multilateral only when it absolutely positively must. These distinctions in the global public eye were lost, I think, on many, many people. I mean, the only people who saw Western humanitarian interventions, if that's what you want to call them, in Kosovo and East Timor as legitimate humanitarian interventions were principally Western democratic publics and the people of Kosovo and East Timor. Elsewhere in the developing world, there was this surging resentment that was going to take form at some point. Now, where I would part ways, of course, is I think that the degree of harm done by specific policy choices compounds that bubbling resentment. The degree of transparency in this era of instant communications into those harms, I mean, we've done plenty of harms in our history, as of most countries and certainly most great powers, but the fact that that is broadcast instantly into living rooms and so forth obviously makes a profound difference. Now, you characterize one of my lines as saying, one of my prescriptions as being apologize for George Bush. Actually, precisely because I do in some measure agree with Bob, I actually was saying, trying to say anyway, something a little bit deeper and more structural, which is that we have to look very specifically at the components of the erosion of U.S. influence. And hard power is the axis, the abacus on which we've been measuring ourselves for so long. It's a handy one because we've tended to do really well on that one. It's like Yankee fans who look at the number of home runs they're hitting this season. You know, it's a good one to keep focusing on when the rest of the infrastructure is imploding. But if you look at the other components of influence, namely, I mean, hard power legitimacy or other people's perception that we're using our power properly, and the crucial one that I don't think we talk near enough about, competence, other people's perception that we're prepared to use our power competently and actually set goals and employ the right means, the necessary means to meet those goals, whether military, diplomatically, economically, whatever. I think that that erosion of influence, which has been given a great push in the downward direction by specific policy choices and specific relationships to international institutions and allies and so forth, I think that's profoundly what we need to reckon with. And so the apology is not for George Bush, it's a reckoning with the components of that loss of influence. So it's a reckoning with our hard power deficiencies that you've mentioned. It's a reckoning with our competence problem, that we're no longer the country that put the man on the moon. Even if at the time we put the man on the moon, we weren't the country that put the man on the moon. That was the perception. And of course, our legitimacy issue. I just like to, in my what's left of my little time, just to flag what I take to be the central challenges with very brief sort of remedies. One, first and foremost, and I think, again, it overlaps with one of Bob's arguments, but first problem I would call the frozen in amber problem. Dick Clark characterized the senior individuals within the Bush administration as being frozen in amber through the 1990s when ethnic conflict and nation building and failing states and so forth, the disorder that Jim writes about, were the issues of the day, and believing that Russia and China, this sort of very distinctly statist 20th century mentality, that they hadn't caught up to the new world, terrorism, of course, being atop the list. I think there's a real danger in the Democratic Party establishment of a frozen in amber problem that vents and or channels a lot of its rage, channels so much of its rage towards George Bush, towards the Bush administration, that it misses some of these shifts, some of these trends, some of these pre-existing trends. And so that frozen in amber problem is something I think we have to adjust to the world as it is, not the world that we wish it there was. Second problem is a chicken and egg problem, which again Bob gets into in his paper, and that is that there is this kind of recognition, largely loosely, that national security and sort of human rights, human dignity, secure states, what goes on inside other states, that those two things are linked in a way that used to be very controversial, that there is a linkage. Now, sometimes the linkage isn't great. You democratize and worse elements come to the fore and you end up more endangered, you feel anyway, with radicals in charge. But the idea that what goes on inside states is somehow irrelevant to our security seems to me anyway like a very passé notion. But the chicken and egg problem is that the United States now without making a rupture with the past and sort of addressing some of these tectonic plate shifts, actually can do great harm to some of the very elements we would like to see ascendant in unstable or deteriorating states. So, Jim, if I had an issue with there are two issues. One is, if we give the Iranian opposition $50 million, we undermine the Iranian opposition, and especially if we boast about it in the way that we tend to do. Even though we want to shore up failing states and deal with disorder as one of the principal measures of potential harm to U.S. interests, do we have the legitimacy and the competence to be the failing state shorer-upper? And do we have the summoning power within international institutions to get others to come to our side to be part of some conglomerate of failing state shorer-uppers? I'm not so sure. So we have this chicken and egg problem where performance is going to be linked to legitimacy, and yet neutrality is not an option. So you're either, as Bob put it, I'm running out of time, but you're either supporting an autocratic state and then potentially engendering resentments that come back and haunt you in blowback, or you're not supporting an autocratic state, and the way that we've done it lately is preaching about what an autocratic state should do with itself, thereby potentially undermining moderates because of our legitimacy problems and our influence problem. Third and final point is, when I said that the global war on terror, I just want to reiterate what Fareed said, is not the appropriate rubric, that does not mean I don't think terrorism is not the most important threat. I think terrorism is the most important threat. I just think by creating a frame that amounts to, at least in my, conjures up for me and many, according to poll data anyway, most Americans, a kind of on-off switch, we actually miss the opportunity to define achievable ends. And so for me, terrorism, radical Islam, eliminationist Islam, that is the nature of the threat. That may be the symptom of larger structural problems, but we have to deal with that threat as it is. And yet by calling it a war, we sort of set ourselves up for excesses that are actually going to create more of those threats. And I think that if we instead broke it down, disaggregated what the goods are that we actually seek to promote and actually may conceivably achieve, namely, actually making ourselves more resilient in the face of attack. We don't talk about this at all because this is politically totally unpalatable. But are we actually better prepared to deal with natural disaster? It doesn't seem like it. A terrorist attack now, maybe a little bit at the margins, but it's politically so unpalatable. We haven't dealt with that. That's something we can measure. We could measure whether more people were rooting for us in this struggle than were rooting against us. That's something we can achieve. We can measure, are we throwing the rule book out as we try to defeat these threats, or are we playing by the rules that have made America great and respected? And those are measurables, and that's why I just don't think the global war on terror is what we need. Let's disaggregate it and create goals we can achieve. Thanks.
Jim, do you want to take up?
Yes. Why don't I take up on some of the points that have been made by you, Fareed, and also by Samantha? And specifically, let me address three points that have been raised vis-a-vis what I was saying and some of the others. First, the idea of what is the single most priority threat that I'm concerned about. Second, is the global war on terror a proper way of dealing with things? And then third, one specifically directed at me, since I was worried about the rising disorder in the world, including domestically, did I want to make American foreign policy centered around what seems to be a kind of impossibly broad task. So let me address each of those. Well, I, like several others, but also different from several others that we'll be talking later at our conference, I do believe that the principal threat comes from, as you said, radical jihadists, or what I would say, Islamist terrorist of global reach, to use the phrase of the Bush administration right at the beginning after 9/11. But I want to also say that the war on terror is not the right way to go about it. First, as was well known, there's a big difference between terror and terrorist. If you had talked about the war against Germany as the war on tanks, that would have been preposterous. And so, too, I think the war on terror is preposterous. There are terrorists, but again, not just terrorists, but rather it's not just any terrorist, but it is Islamist or jihadist terrorist. And I also want to distinguish between Islamics or and Islamists. There's something we're moving rather further down the radical element. And so I think there's a real problem with the word terror. It should actually be Islamist terrorist of global reach. But there's also a problem with the word war. I argue that instead of having war with the U.S. military at the center of this, directing our concern at this threat, rather it should be, if you will, policing. There might be the local militaries, I argue for that, the local militaries in the various countries, like Afghanistan, to take a current example, but that are going to be crucial, but not the U.S. military. And rather that what's really engaging here is that dealing with terrorists is much more a policing action than it is a war action. Now, in America, we do not have anything that is so common in foreign countries, like Latin countries, both in Latin America and in Latin Europe. In Italy, they have the Carabinieri. In Spain, they have the Guardia Civil, or armored police. The idea that you can have a national police with a sort of militarized capability, this is something foreign to us, quite properly so. But it's not only not foreign to other countries, but indeed other countries often find it essential. So when I say policing, I just don't mean the friendly cop on the beat, although that's crucial, but I mean a militarized capability in some states. But that doesn't mean the U.S. military doing it. And finally, the global war on terror, I think, is casting it wrong. It should be, as I'm suggesting, the policing of Islamist terrorists of global reach. Put the global someplace else. So clearly, I disagree completely with the GWAT that the Bush administration created. There are a number of our paper givers that are very concerned about saying the real threat is not Islamist terrorists, and they make good case for that. They, for example, we'll be getting to those later. But I can understand why they're concerned about that, because when the Bush administration made that their central concern, then they ran amok. And I'm saying there was still a possibility of making that the central concern, but coming up with a much wiser policy. Now, the third point was, doesn't it seem a very extensive task, an impossible task, to try to stabilize countries as our principle of American foreign policy? And I couldn't agree more. We cannot stabilize the countries and make that a principle of American foreign policy. What I'm arguing for are not so much acts of commission on the part of the United States vis-a-vis foreign states, including weak states, but acts of omission. In particular, I argue there are a number of other states out there, most obviously rather more, shall we say, 20th century modern rather than 21st century postmodern states, most obviously Russia, China, and India, that are perfectly interested in joining in their own particular country, their own particular region, their own particular near abroad, the policing of terror. And we should devolve that ability to them. As I argue in the paper, we should be the hegemon of hegemons, and I mean hegemony in John Eikenberry's way, not empire, but hegemony. We should be that. And so one last thing. If we had had the acts of omission, we would not have invaded Iraq. We would have understood there was already a state that can be kept in its box and can keep Islamist terrorists down. We would not have invaded Iraq. We would not be continually criticizing Russia and often criticizing China. We would follow the path put forward in the paper that we're here tomorrow by Stephen Van Evera. So I would argue there would be acts of omission. There are a lot of things we've done we wouldn't do, not much acts of commission, and one of the acts of omission, as I argue in the paper, is no more counterinsurgency. So the American military would not really be involved at all in establishing this order I have in mind. Rather, we enable or aid local militaries and police to do that.
Bob Kagan, do you want to just take a few minutes to respond to Jim Kurtz's prescriptive part? Because this idea of acts of omission that try to keep parts of the world that are stable, don't criticize Russia, don't criticize China, strikes me as very different from the tenor of your paper.
Well, you know, since I don't think our foreign policy can be all about, you know, dealing with Islamic jihadism, even though I recognize that that's the greatest possibility of disastrous event, I don't think that can be the sum and substance of our foreign policy. So since I believe that the world has become what it has almost always been, which is a world of competing nation states, which is going to also attract our attention and be something, I don't think that we can look at the world as being only about Islamic radicalism, therefore everyone who's on our side is our friend and we're not going to have any problem with them. The truth is, the Russians don't see us as their ally in this fight. They're perfectly happy to kill as many potential Islamic radicals as they can. That doesn't lead them to say we and the Americans can work together on this. The Chinese are delighted that we are mostly really sort of off their back because they want to be, but they don't see us as a potential ally. So we can't pretend that we are allies with people who don't want to be allies with us. And not to mention, I think that we're going to have clashes of one kind or another, not necessarily armed clashes, but clashes with them on a whole broad range of issues. And so we would be deluding ourselves if we thought that if we just look at this one issue, this is the one thing we agree about and try to base our entire foreign policy on that.
David Kennedy, you want to take up Jim Kurtz's second point, which relates directly to your paper, which is what should the American military do and how should it be constituted to do it well?
Well, let me go back to another point that James Kurth mentioned, and others, other papers have brought this up as well, as we'll see in the course of discussion, is how should we scale the degree of threat that terror poses to the United States? And while I agree with Samantha Power that we certainly must recognize terror as some kind of threat, I don't know that it falls in the category of an existential threat to our national security, the way, for example, the overhang of umpteen thousand Soviet missiles did during the Cold War period. I don't mean to trivialize at all the trauma and the damage of 9/11, but I think that by the way these things are usually measured, that event constituted no really deep threat to our national sovereignty in terms of our political and territorial integrity. So I think there were probably historical reasons as well as immediate political reasons why that threat took on the, I think, somewhat exaggerated character that it did. The deeper historical reason, I believe, is because this country, for all kinds of historically accidental reasons, through much of its history, enjoyed a degree of national security at a very low price, such has been given to very few societies in the course of history. It's an accident of geography and the isolation of the United States and North America. We had no neighbors to fear. We had a very small standing military naval establishment for the first century and a half of our existence. And yet we felt utterly and completely secure from the threat of foreign intervention, territorial takeover, overthrow of our regime, or what have you, the kinds of things that other states reflexively think about when they talk about their own national security. So there are historical and deep cultural reasons, I think, why we as a people and our leadership in that moment may have exaggerated the degree of threat that was posed. And I also want to go back to something that Bob Kagan said or that you said about him, about what degree of break is there in the Bush administration's policies with historical precedent. There's one way in which the Bush administration, it seems to me, is quite continuous with a longer, earlier period of history, and that is in the instrument that it chose with which to wage the so-called war on terror or to respond to the provocation of 9/11, and that was a very traditional military campaign. For all the talk of having entered a new era after 9/11 and a new international regime in which novel instruments of power would be necessary and so on, The fact is that the bulk of the American response to that event has consisted in two very traditional military operations, one in Afghanistan and one in Iraq. And a question arises, why was that the reflexive response of the administration? I think among the reasons that that was the response is because, as I argue in the paper, of the kind of military force that we've evolved, and it's the way it's embedded in a very peculiar constellation of civil military relations due to its relatively small size, its all-volunteer character, and the fact that, as you said, Fareed, it subsists on what is a strikingly modest claim on the economic resources of the larger society. In a $13 trillion economy, a $500 million Defense Department appropriation is approaching the category of loose change. So the ease with the military force becomes the first choice, the preferred instrument of policy, is something that worries me. I think it was inappropriate in this case. I think the structure of the civil-military configuration that we have makes that possible again in the future, no matter who's in office. So among the things that I argue is that we need some mechanism to give more substance to Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 11 of the Constitution, which is the phrase that locates war-making power in the Congress. We don't need to take that literally, perhaps, as reinforcing Congress's role in this matter, but I do think we can take it metaphorically. The founders were looking for a way to discipline the use of military force, to make some kind of democratic and deliberative, consensual procedures necessary when the resort to force was chosen. I think that mechanism is now extraordinarily weak because we've so far lowered the threshold at which it's easy for the political leadership to resort to force without asking the rest of us to do anything, precisely because we're not required to do anything, given the force structure that we have.
All right, let me at this point move. We have some people who have read the papers in advance and have a few things they might have to say about it. I'm not necessarily going to go one after the other because each person's comments might provoke a discussion and certainly might occasion a quick response from the paper writer. So, Charlie Mayer, you want to tell us something about Bob Kagan's paper?
Bob Kagan's and...
You can't talk about the first 600 words because that has been exhaustively discussed.
I'm overwhelmed by the next 9,400. But in some ways, I'd like to, you know, some of Kagan's paper has, for me, some of the same interesting surprises that some, and listening to him as Jim Kurtz does. And it's a pleasure to see Jim after so many years of being separated. I was expecting to be more put off by Bob Kagan, from what I know. But no, it's okay. No, you do the best you can, and and then I started thinking. First of all, I don't agree. I would separate doctrine and practice. I think it's perhaps, you know, we've had this, talked a lot around the table about seeking a doctrine. I'm not sure that's inappropriate. I know it's an habitual recourse in American foreign policy. I think it leads us into all sorts of inappropriate responses. I'm conservative in the sense of sort of believing in prudence, practice, liberal perhaps in the sense of the ideals that I'd like to see. But I think doctrine doesn't serve us very well. But I think Bob is right that, you know, if we look for a new doctrine, we're not going to be able to put one in its place very quickly because the Bush administration has largely aligned itself with whatever we might call doctrines, which are Wilsonian or interventionist. And I guess I would plead for putting aside doctrine. On the other hand, I disagreed with the paper because I think what I find lamentable about the foreign policy of the last few years is the practice. I don't think it matters what the doctrine is. My sense is that, and obviously this is a very partisan or a very, you know, personal statement, probably half of us will agree and half of us won't, roughly speaking, but my sense is that there was a degree of recklessness in the Bush policy recklessness about thinking about the consequences of what intervention would mean in a fragile society, in a divided society. And this, I think, was something, I won't say it's new, but it's something I don't think we thought about in the same way. Now, look, there are interventions. I'm a casuist, since I don't believe in doctors. I think sometimes there are good interventions, and you know, I will applaud Kosovo, and I think sometimes there are interventions which are not good and not worth pursuing. Clinton clearly went into Eastern Africa, you know, with disastrous results, and then panicked, I think, with disastrous results. But my sense is that there is more difference with the Bush administration in terms of its practice, in terms of the actual thinking through, trying to psych out a situation, and then in trying to find reasonable cause to convince the public. Now, you know, I think back, and there was Franklin Roosevelt in the 1940 also seeking intervention, grounds for intervention. There was Lyndon Johnson in 64. Nonetheless, I would separate, have to look at what I think, you know, from at least my judgment, are the reasons and whether they would be, this would be casuistry, you know, which ones I can support and which ones I can't. And I can't support this one. My own sense is that the notion that the United States, to resort to surprise preemption, these may have occurred in the past. My sense is that this is not really the historical the gravamen of our foreign policy. So I find that the sense of continuity is just too strong, and especially if we look at try and separate these dimensions of praxis and doctrine. What does that stop. Mean? 1 minute or stop?
That means stop unless you really want to go on.
I want to be cooperative, and maybe there'll be another. Bob, I certainly think one other last statement. I don't think it does as much good to thematize one overarching problem. I mean, terror may be the flavor of the problem for the day, but clearly, if a confrontation arose in the Taiwan Strait, where nuclear weapons gradually, we've seen escalatory processes were involved, this could make terror seem, not mild, but clearly put into perspective. We will have an assortment of problems, and I don't think it does as much good to say this is over an overarching problem.
Bob, do you want to just respond to the issue of the doctrine versus practice? Because it certainly, my reaction to your comments was, you know, at a level, my sense of your book projects is to show that there has been one doctrine for 225 years. In a sense, that then becomes a somewhat unhelpful concept to distinguish the variety of American foreign policy. If at some level you're saying they've all been the same, even if you're right, in a sense, it becomes very difficult to then analyze which ones are different in various ways. And I think what Charlie is suggesting, maybe if we come down from that abstract and perhaps appropriate level of doctrine, how would you describe the Bush practice?
Brilliant, you know, stunningly fantastic. I mean, I agree with Charlie that, you know, that's my point, is that these really aren't questions of doctrine. The doctrine is pretty basic. I mean, and in terms of if you want to make historical evaluations, which presidents do we like, who's our favorite president, top five, the bottom five, you know, doctrine is not going to be the one that gets you there. It is going to be fundamentally execution. I totally agree with Samantha, of course, that the issue of competence is overwhelming. It's very easy to look at the wars that go badly and see how stupid the people were who got us into those wars. But, you know, often what I love about this is that the people who got us into this war, this was the A-team. These were the adults. These were the ones we were so glad to have in power after, you know, after the amateur hour of the Clinton administration. You know, these were the big guys who got everything right in Bush 1. Well, I will go out of my way to exclude you from any consensus that I may suggest. But I do think that the question is not one of doctrine, but of execution. And I do think that there was an element of recklessness about the way this intervention was conducted, because they clearly didn't have a good idea of how they were supposed to deal with that problem. Now, the only thing I would add to that is that Kosovo was equally reckless. That war didn't turn out the way they expected it to turn out. They thought that, believe me, the Clinton administration officials thought that war was over in 4 days. And the throughout the entire period of the Kosovo conflict, until Milosevic finally caved, they were in a total panic because they had no idea what they were going to do next. It turned out okay. at the end of the day, although not if you're a Serb, maybe, you know, but... And a lot of other, I mean, you know, we could go through a list of America. We don't habitually do this brilliantly. You know, we have a lot of mistakes, including the wars we win. We make a lot of mistakes. So on the one hand, I believe in competence. On the other hand, you're not going to have an easy time deciding who's going to be competent in advance, I guess is what I'd say. And competence is also circumstantial. And, you know.
One last point. Samantha talked about competence. It's not competence for me. It's practice in a certain sense of applying ideas. Whether you do them well, this could have been very competent. I would still have thought it was reckless.
Oh, well, then you are talking about doctrine.
No, I don't think so.
Well, keeps you out of Iraq? I mean, I guess the question is, what doctrine or set of principles keeps you out of Iraq?
Well, decent respect for the opinions of mankind, I think, you know.
Well, could you retroactively apply that to every other intervention?
No. I mean, you know, I have great trouble about, you know, let's say James K. Polk. I'm glad to have all that territory, but I think it was appalling, you know, aggressive.
Well, my point is that you couldn't come up with a set of, I guess I would argue, you couldn't come up with a set of principles that would keep you out of Iraq for sure, that wouldn't also have kept you out of half a dozen, if not almost all, the wars that America has ever fought. Okay, that's if we can agree on that, then we can, you know.
Well,
we
that's
can
why I
on.
Said I'm a casualist.
Yeah.
But there are other layers of analysis here between doctrine and execution. Things like judgment.
Like what?
Judgment. Assessing the scale of the threat. Assessing the finitude of the means available to deal with it. Those aren't exactly either in the category of doctrine or execution. Maybe they trail off into execution. But it seems to me that's the level, the juncture at which the Bush administration made some very large errors.
It's impossible to disagree with that statement, except that if we were sitting down here and you wanted to say for the next administration, this is how you need judgment and this is what it is, what would you say?
Well, I'd just parse judgment a little bit, the scale of the threat and the scale of the resources available to address it.
Well, you know, but then here you had a situation where the scale of the threat in Iraq was roughly agreed. It wasn't just the Bush administration thought. So you had most of the foreign policy community of the country, including certainly the entire Clinton administration, agreeing with this mistake, you know, sharing this mistake in judgment. So, you know, it would be one thing if you could only find two people who'd made this mistake and they happened to take us to war, but if you have a whole political class and a whole foreign policy elite with, well, let me say, noble and wonderful exceptions who made that same judgmental error, I don't know whether you can really say much about judgment as we move forward.
All right. I think what we'll do now is move to Neil Ferguson, who's going to talk about Samantha Power. I just am worried about the clock, so I'm moving things forward a little.
Yes, I'm just thinking as that conversation is going on, though, that although there was a consensus in the United States for intervention in Iraq, there was not a consensus on the UN Security Council. There was certainly not a consensus among America's allies. I think that's an important distinction to make. Another distinction we're in danger of losing sight of here is the one between Afghanistan and Iraq. One intervention was, it seems to me, eminently justified on the basis of the intelligence that was available, and the other wasn't. But let me switch now to Samantha's paper, which I tried to read in the context of all the other papers. It seems to me that we're all addressing the same questions. One of them is whether there was a Bush doctrine that was novel, and we disagree on that. Samantha's one of those, like me, who thinks it was novel, both in conception and particularly in practice. We all take different views on what the threats currently are that a post-Bush administration faces. Some of us think there are traditional great power rivalries that we should worry about more than Islamic extremism, or should I say Islamist extremism. And some of us think we're in a very new world where radical new threats confront the United States, and I think Samantha's one of those in that second group. Which I think I also belong to, namely a group that thinks we're in very new territory. Though within that group there's some difference between those who think that radical Islamism poses a fundamental threat requiring military and other quite extreme solutions, and those who think it's a little local difficulty calling for constabulary duties of a colonial variety, which is, among other people's, Jim Kurth's argument, and I think one that I'm quite sympathetic to. Where we get into really interesting territory with Samantha's paper is when it comes to solutions, the what is to be done question. I'd like to venture a summary of all the papers and then show you that Samantha's is the outlier. It's the extreme or radical solution. Essentially, there are five different models or solutions that we all have considered. One I'm going to call Rome, which is the imperial model, which I would say is a kind of recommendation for continuation of the Bush administration's policy of unilateralism and the use of military force. Not many people, it seems to me, perhaps nobody, is in favor of a continuation of Rome, even those who may briefly have been in favor of it. But it's certainly in the room as one of our models. The second very popular model is Westphalia, back to sovereign states. Though it's not clear from all of the papers who favors competition or, if you like, a balance of power out of rivalry, and those who favor something more like a concert. So I want to distinguish between Westphalia, sovereign states in competition with one another, or great powers in competition with one another, and Vienna, in which the sovereign states dance or perform in some kind of concert. That's to say, a post-1815 Metternichian order. There's a substantial nostalgia in the room for what I'm going to call San Francisco. But you could also actually call it, following David Kennedy's paper, Versailles. That's to say, the sovereign states get together and agree on some kind of institutionalization of liberal order. That's my fourth, and I think that's the current favorite. We all like to go back to 1945, secretly, unlimited American power and the opportunity to put Wilsonian ideals into practice. But the fifth model, which is, I think, Samantha's, I think is the postmodern rather than post-war order. That's to say, it's Brussels, or maybe Doha. It's something which implies an extension of the power of international or supranational bodies over sovereign states. What's fascinating about Samantha's paper is the way in which she sets out the case for increasing the power of supranational bodies. I think it's done in some ways between the lines rather than in black and white. But if you read through her solutions to the problem of the Bush administration's jet, red, white, and blue incompetence, a wonderful phrase which I hope will catch on. The most striking is this. The United States should, I quote, work within international institutions to galvanize state-by-state commitments to enforce the responsibility to protect, broaden to include physical security and economic security, freedom from fear and want. Now, the responsibility to protect is a very important code word for what I'd see as the humanitarian interventionist school of empire. And that is to say, the argument here is that there should be more intervention, but for better causes, stopping genocide rather than necessarily overthrowing dictators we don't like anymore. It's one of four solutions that Samantha's paper sets out for the broken post-Bush foreign policy order. The interesting thing is that her key objective in the paper is to establish or re-establish the connection between, and I quote, domestic and global imperatives, to build a popular base for foreign policy, to persuade Americans again of the need for sacrifice. But each of her solutions, and I'll conclude at this point, the red card having been shown. Incidentally, there should be a yellow card before the red card. I'm a soccer fan, you can tell.
Play soccer, so you...
I'll treat that as the yellow. The four solutions, one of which I've already mentioned, namely to extend the power of the United Nations and other supranational bodies, include more immigrants. We should let lots and lots of Iraqi refugees in. We should scrap Gitmo Bay and the use of torture, and we should denounce George W. Bush at every available opportunity. I can't think of four things more likely to annoy the American electorate than those four things, actually. So in a sense, there's a fundamental contradiction in your paper. You want to reestablish the legitimacy of foreign policy in the United States, but all four of the things you suggest will actually annoy a majority of American voters, and in some cases, annoy them quite a lot.
Samantha, you have 2 or 3 minutes.
Mel Loeffler has done a magnificent job setting up this conference, but I really do think we have to rethink the structure, because Fareed and Neil get to characterize our my paper in this instance, everybody's paper, then we end up responding to the characterization rather than actually making the argument. And I really think that is, I think you're projecting your knowledge of me from 10 years or maybe another. I don't know. You said it was between the lines. So it was in the white spaces because it was not in the text, this Brussels evocation. In fact, so let me sort of try to amend the portrayal of the paper. So I mentioned earlier the chicken and egg problem and the frozen and amber problem. To me, the greatest problem, perhaps, when it comes to dealing with any of the threats that we've touched upon, whether it's the rise of new powers, the rise of rogue nations, the rise of transnational jihadists and so forth, is the problem of the commons. It's that actually very few actors within the international system want to play in the commons, want to make sacrifices domestically, want to have difficult domestic conversations about committing police forces to any kind of antidote to failing states. Look at the debates in Canada and in the Netherlands now, but even maintaining troop contributions in Afghanistan. A sense that if you affiliate with the United States global war on terror, you undermine your own security. So a very self-interested calculus that actually opting out of security commitments is good for you, and so it's bad for Afghanistan, maybe in the long term a little bit bad for the world. But, I mean, time horizons that we're all familiar with in domestic political cycles. So actually, far from the Brussels evocation, I have profound despair, which I think is very explicit in the paper, about the 192 countries who make up the United Nations. And what I sort of am trying to encourage us to do, me to do perhaps, is to just have the discipline to think country by country about domestic political calculations and why again and again they're cutting in favor of opting out of dealing with the commons. And responsibility to protect, I mean, you're absolutely right at the end of the paper, but what I was referring to is actually taking this concept that has been on the international agenda now and has been very tied up with humanitarian intervention, and that's what it grows out of for sure, and actually try to hone down on the issue of civilian protection. Because when we promote democracy as we have promoted it, and it's no secret that it's conflated now with regime change and with electocracy, but I think we're missing the central dimension of how people are living their lives abroad, which is they are voting in those elections that are put before them for more extreme elements because they are experiencing fear and want. That is, why does Hamas win? Hamas wins because the militants patrol the neighborhood and because of the social service dimension. So what I'm actually thinking about is more in terms of, and this is again to Jim's point, about governing institutions in societies that can actually enhance individual dignity. It's basically a conception of justice. And the United States by no means can be the carrier of this burden. But the United States has to think very carefully rather than snapping its fingers and expecting the constabulary from other countries to come and bail us out. Right now, there are no takers within international institutions. So I just think it's really, when you look at the G77, when you look at Europe, when you look at China, these are not arrangements or entities within international institutions who are willing to look at the list of threats as we perceive them and respond and contribute the resources that they can. And so we've got to work country by country. And talk about the domestic base. Right now everybody's nostalgic for San Francisco. They're nostalgic for international institutions. Wait till they show up in those international institutions when George Bush isn't president and get the kind of response that they're going to get from these countries until these countries are enlisted in understanding that these threats are grave and not just threats made up in the mind of George Bush.
I'm sorry, you thought I misrepresented your paper. Of course, it was hard to represent the bits that had TK to come beside them and hadn't written. But can I just come back at you? Because, I mean, I do think it's absolutely implicit in what you say that something has to be done to override domestic political impulses to do the wrong thing.
Not going to come at a superstate level. You're not going to chalk down to countries and then have them override.
But I don't know how else to understand what you've said when you talk about use of international institutions to galvanize state-by-state commitments to enforce the responsibility to protect. I mean, what do these words mean if they do not mean mean some coercion of the individual state. What is always talk about a trained, trained culturally ambidextrous police, more aid. I mean, who's organizing all of this? Because you clearly don't think it should be the United States unilaterally. So who?
I mean, I think 192 countries in the UN. Very few of them can be counted on to play, as I've indicated. Necessity in failing states and in repressive states. That is, both are creating threats galore and ungoverned spaces not getting tended to. So the question then becomes, well, in an ideal world, everybody would read the newspaper in Angela Merkel's Germany and Thabo Mbeki's South Africa, and they'd say, you know, I think our government should play. They should be a part within international institutions of tending to these threats. That's what needs to happen. It's not happening right now, in part because I think Bush has provided a useful distraction and alibi for countries for not showing up. And there is a deficit in leadership. But what has to happen is the threats have to get disentangled from George Bush. Right now, anything associated with Bush, people seem to want to do the opposite. And the next president, this is why I come back to this issue of reckoning and rupture from what has been done, has to do this delicate diplomacy behind the scenes, and we're going to have institutions where resources are pooled. But George Soros is not going to supply the resources to shore up failing states. It's ultimately going to come through the parts that comprise the whole.
I think this is a good discussion because there is a tension within certain elements of liberal thought about what needs to be done and the means by which you do it. In other words, there is a desire to will the ends without willing the means, because the means either involve American power or unilateralism and such. And I think that in some ways, I do think some liberals have to ask themselves, if you can't will the means, are you willing to do nothing? In other words, that has to be on the table. How important are these means, that the means be persuasive, consensus-driven, and all those things? Of course, if that happens, that'd be wonderful. But what if it doesn't happen? Then are you comfortable with Darfur as it is, or are you not? And I'm going to... You can come back. Frank, do you want to talk about Jim Kurth's paper? And I'd love to get some discussion going about this whole issue of the nature of the world we're living in, because as the part of your paper that Neil praised, Samantha, was this description of the world that we are living in. And Jim talks about that extensively. Yeah, what I'm going to do, Les, just so you know, is Frank is going to talk about Jim Kurth's paper. Steve Van Evere is going to talk about Kennedy's. Very brief responses, and then the paper writers are not going to talk anymore. It's just going to be the rest of the distinguished gathering, unless it's on precisely this point.
There's no precise point. So.
Thank you for your candor. Thank you for your candor. Frank.
Well, I guess I was asked to comment on Jim's paper because our analyses are coincident up to a certain point. So he, like me, believes that one of the big problems is disorder, the lack of sovereignty, the absence of this Westphalian world. I think this is actually only true of the greater Middle East, and that if you deal with East Asia, you're still back in that old world of sovereign states, and so you need a different set of tools. But certainly in this area, I think that's... the case, and I would agree with him in saying that if the problem is restoring authority and state sovereignty, military and certainly U.S., you know, unilateral military application of force is not the solution. And so it is more like a police problem than a military problem, and calling it a war I think is wrong. I guess where I begin to part company is first... Well, and I guess there's a prior point where I might part company, which is in terms of the threat, if I can throw in my two cents here. We had this debate right after September 11th about why they hate us, which I thought was actually quite an interesting one. And we came to the conclusion that they hate us for what we are rather than what we do. And I think that discussion was over too quickly, because I think we ought to give some serious thought to the idea that they hate us for our foreign policy, and therefore if you change aspects of your foreign policy, the threat level will decrease. And I think that is a way of dealing with some of these problems that comes outside of the, you know, how you construct the empire. Now, where I disagree, I guess, with Jim is that I think he's got this kind of 19th century view of how you establish order. that doesn't take account of where the sources of state weakness in the contemporary world come from, because it doesn't account for mobilized populations, for new social groups, for the forces of globalization that make sovereignty inherently difficult to exercise in many different parts of the world. And this idea that you basically get strong, order-loving allies either in the individual countries, or worse yet, get Russia and China to do it in a kind of revived empire, I think misunderstands the possibilities for getting back to that that Westphalian world. I actually think that in many parts of the world it's not going to be possible to, or to the extent that you get order and strong states, it has to be based on an endogenous process. Legitimacy is really important to this, and outside states cannot, in many cases, provide that legitimacy. And therefore, to the extent that you get this restoration of order, you know, the outsiders will help here and there. But I would also say to Samantha that I also doubt that the international community can provide a lot of that state reconstruction, because it has inherent limits. And again, as I said, if it's really an endogenous problem, then the exogenous forces are going to only help at the margins. Jim, your verbal explanation of what you were saying, I thought diverged from what I thought I had read in the paper, because I didn't get that point about Russia and China and relying on all these other people to impose order. And I think that's just, I mean, that's horrifying. I mean, the only places where these guys, where those two countries are going to provide any kind of order, China will do it in Tibet, and Russia will do it in Ukraine, Georgia, and other parts of the near abroad, just like they did, you know, this wonderful effort they undertook in Chechnya. And I just don't, you know, and that's a perfect example of how that old 19th century approach to order just doesn't work. I think the way they intervened in Chechnya produced much more terrorism, just like our intervention in Iraq produced more terrorism, because it was this old, you know, imperial mindset about how you go about creating order that really doesn't take legitimacy and all these other, you know, factors into account. And these other great powers are really not going to help you in other parts of the world. They're not going to help you in Sudan or in other parts of sub-Saharan Africa. They're not going to help you in Lebanon. They're not going to help you in Palestine. They're not going to help you in the actual places where having a strong state would actually contribute something. So I get my prescriptive part tomorrow, but I think that's the limit. I mean, that's what I would say is the limitation of that of Jim's analysis, or my view of the limitations of Jim's analysis.
Jim, a quick response, or
yes. I agree that I start with a 19th century model, but I think that I try to modernize it, if you will, or postmodernize it. Now, you specifically said that I have to take into account first the existing mobilization of social groups, and I believe I do. I'll explain that in a second. And second, that I should take into account the realities of globalization, and that makes it extremely difficult, presumably, to have strong states for fairly familiar reasons. Well, let me say in regard to the social mobilization, I probably should have underlined it more in the paper, but I literally said it three or four times, that a strong state, which is what I'm arguing for, had to be grounded and rooted in a broad social base. I didn't use the word legitimacy, but that's because I had in mind sociology, if you will. I specifically said that authoritarian states per se are not strong states. They have to be grounded in a strong social base. And I gave two examples. The best one, this is the way it happened in Europe and in America, was a strong, large middle class. But in other countries, it can be a strong ethnic majority. If an authoritarian state is not grounded in that, it's not going to have the strong base. It won't have, therefore, either its social legitimacy or, I mean, its social base or its political legitimacy. So that's the way I would argue that. We take advantage of the fact that certain groups are, in fact, mobilized, and we certainly take that into reality. As far as globalization goes, I agree with what you say. We have to take globalization into account. Except, and this will horrify you even more, in the 1990s, there was one definition of globalization. And that was the American definition. And that was, not surprisingly, eroding states. Well, the Russians and the Chinese and the Indians all have their own versions of globalization. They're profiting from it, and they support it with Russian, Indian, and Chinese characteristics. And they do not see their kind of globalization to compete with their strong states. They see our kinds. So I think there's an alternative way to look at it.
Soccer card. Steve?
One last thing. In the paper, I did not say that the Russians and the Chinese will aid us in most of the areas of the world. I specifically say, and I said in the verbal thing, in their own territory, I'm thinking principally the Chinese, and admittedly, I write off Tibet, and especially Xinjiang, that is to say the Muslims in Xinjiang, in their own territory, and in their near abroad. That's what's relevant for the Russians in their own way, Indians. In other words, where it becomes operational in terms of Islamist terrorists, operational vis-a-vis China. For Russia, it means Central Asia. In other words, I am admitting to allow their Central Asia to be the equivalent of our Central America. That's it. Yeah.
Steve, David Kennedy's.
I greatly enjoyed David Kennedy's paper. It brought two questions foremost to my mind that I think need further debate and discussion. One, I'll just mention, maybe if there's time to return to it, we can, which is, does Wilsonian foreign policy succeed? Does it work? David's a proponent of following Wilsonian ideas and practices. I think it's worth asking, and I think we need writing and research on this. Well, is, in fact, Wilsonian, the body of Wilsonian tricks and ideas, an effective toolkit for solving today's problems? To what extent can we really defeat the threats we face today by promoting democracy? To what extent can we do it by promoting a prosperous world, by promoting free trade? To what extent can we do it by fostering strong global institutions? I think it's a great question. We can talk more. A second question is, why were the American people persuaded to pay the price of Bush's foreign policy, especially of the war in Iraq? David argues that we had here a failure of popular sovereignty, that what happened here is that those who pay the piper weren't calling the tune, as Kant would think, that because we now have an all-volunteer force, there was a loss of control of the people over the foreign policy. And I guess I would ask him how he would respond to a different way of looking at it, which is, first of all, that an all-volunteer army doesn't really represent a loss of control. It represents really a reduction in the public's perceived cost of a foreign adventure. So maybe the label should be different. The question is, why do the American people believe, not so much why do they approve of this, but why do they believe the cost would be small? And his theory is that it's the all-volunteer force and the fact that we don't, as a whole broad society, pay the cost for this. I had three other explanations, or maybe four other explanations that might be talked about. First, I think those who were against the Bush policy have to face up to the fact that the American people were persuaded to wage this war, and I think they were persuaded by it because I think if you look at the domestic scene in the U.S. today, the conservative movement is by far the most powerful, well-organized, influential, coherent and persuasive force in the United States today. It's a remarkable political movement. I think we've never seen anything quite like it before in our history, and it dominates the high ground in politics for good reasons, which is it's the most competent force out there. And those who don't like the conservative movement's foreign policy, I think should sort of stop whining about it and argue with it, because it sort of won the argument fair and square about where we ought to go in the world in the early part of the century. I was against the Iraq War, I should say. So I'm not arguing that, you know, we got the right result. I'm just saying we have in this country a domestic situation where you have a very powerful movement that won an argument. There are three other things to think about. One is I believe that you had a recurrence of a chronic American popular mistake as Americans thought about Iraq that we've made again and again in the past, and again, I wish there was more research on this. I think the United States society, its government and its people, have a recurrent error they've made for over 100 years, which is to underestimate the power of nationalism. We do it again and again and again. We did it in Vietnam. We've done it elsewhere. I think we do it because we are a multi-ethnic society of immigrants who have learned to get along with each other, and so we have sort of a Rodney King, as you remember him years ago, saying, why don't we learn to just get along? Let's get along. Why don't you guys get along? We can get along in Chicago, us Irish and Italians and everybody. You folks overseas do the same thing. And overseas is different. Non-immigrant societies are different. Overseas nationalism is different. Here, immigrant societies can learn to shave the hard edges off of their nationalism, but that's not how nationalism abroad works. And one of the fundamental precepts of foreign policy should always be don't get your foreign policy crosswise to nationalism because your ship will wreck on it. Nationalism's not rational. It's a little crazy. It's like the nuclear energy of modern politics. And so don't mess with it. And we're running into that with the Sunni nationalists today. So another reason we underestimated the cost in Iraq was, or the reason we paid them is we didn't know they were coming. We didn't know they were coming because we miss, as we have so often before, it's like, you know, Charlie Brown kicking footballs. I'll just say the other two points. One is we failed to understand that conventional superiority militarily is not superiority in counterinsurgency. And this reflects an American, you know, abysmal public misunderstanding of security policy. The American people should go and learn something about war before they go get in them, okay? We don't teach about war in college. We don't talk about it seriously in public discourse. Simple things like the fact that, there's a difference between a conventional battlefield and a counterinsurgency situation didn't penetrate our public discourse. And so the fact that we could, of course, crush the Iraqi army like a rotten tin can didn't translate into an understanding, well, yeah, there's a second phase in this war, counterinsurgency, and we're no good at it. There was no reason before this war to think we were any better at counterinsurgency than we were in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And thirdly, we didn't know ourselves. My final point is we're an insular society. Our public doesn't know much about the world. Our government doesn't know much about the world. We're the last people in the world who should be trying complicated social engineering overseas, okay? Because our public, you know, knows more about Brittany than Britain. And likes to watch NASCAR. And if we want to be like that, when we go abroad to engineer things, we're going to make a mess. So it shouldn't be a shock that we went into Iraq and made a mess. Until we shape up as a people and stop being insular and learn how the rest of the planet thinks and works, we're going to make messes like this when we go abroad.
It's such a mess in Germany.
Yeah. We have to move to David Kennedy. Let him respond.
Good point.
Well, understanding the constraints of time, I'll try to be very, very brief. Does Wilsonian foreign policy ever work? I would say arguably yes, at the risk of being accused by Neil Ferguson of nostalgia for what is, for all purposes, an intense my hometown of San Francisco. I think the post-World War II era is an historically documented example of the application of measured and tempered Wilsonian principles, respecting a lot of the Westphalian premises about national sovereignty, that worked very, very well, all things considered. No international regime is perfect. The world isn't perfect. But I think that regime, our nostalgia for it, I think, is quite legitimate in some ways. I think it was a regime that served a lot of people's purposes, not just in this country, but elsewhere, quite well. So I think there is, in the historical record, something we can look to there. And I return to a point I made in the paper that what Woodrow Wilson aimed to do was not to make the world democratic. I think that is a distortion, a grotesque distortion of his intention. He aimed, in his famous phrase, to make the world safe for democracy. That's quite a much more modest and tempered aspiration. And secondly, I would just say with respect again to this, the nature of military force, I commend to everybody here, if they haven't already read it, the smartest thing that I've read on this topic recently is a book by a retired British general, Rupert Smith, called The Utility of Force. If you haven't read it, I recommend it very, very strongly. And among other things, he makes just the point that Steve just made about the difference between conventional application of military force and what he calls war among the people or counterinsurgency warfare. And as one shades into that second form of engagement, the question isn't just waging war. It isn't just the original decision to go to war. But the question of sustaining
an appropriate military force in the field with the political will behind it, which in a democratic state like ours means the will of the sovereign people, at least a majority of them, has to be cultivated, nurtured, and sustained over time to make the operation successful. There's a deep history of how people have tried to configure military forces in the post-Vietnam era to ensure that kind of engagement and commitment by the civilian population. We don't have time to go into it in depth here, obviously, because I'm getting my red card. But I think that's what's gone missing here, as it did in Vietnam.
Wonderful. Les, you've been patient. Have you forgotten what you were going to say?
Yeah. Well, I can't see the card to cut me off, so you'll have to cane me when I've gone over.
I'll mention it.
Okay. First of all, I think all the papers are brilliant and all the commentary on the papers are brilliant, though I disagree with a number of points. It seems to me there are 2.5 issues on the table of importance. The one of half importance is whether Bob Kagan is right or wrong on the continuity of the Bush policy with previous history. It seems to me that he's right that Bush didn't invent stupidity and excess. So far as my reading of history is concerned, they existed before. He has, however, risen those things to doctrinal levels. That's the problem with it. And he's added to it arrogance and ignorance. He's made mistakes on just a colossal level. And that's what's distinguishing him. And we see the results of that in the reactions of other countries. Now, as you'll see, another point I'm going to make, I don't care much for reactions of other countries, except as a practical matter. Because I'll disagree with Professor Mayer on this, I don't have much of a respect for the decent opinions of mankind because I don't think they're very decent. Bush goes into Afghanistan, and I applaud it. And then when he's on the verge of victory, he turns to Iraq. There isn't a person here who thought that was the right decision. It was a tremendously flawed strategic decision. Okay? Then he goes into Iraq, and I applauded his going into Iraq. And then, after he wins, there was no preparation for what then? It was just, again, a colossal strategic mistake. Now, I don't know whether you want to call that doctrinal or something else, but when mistakes are made at that level that so profoundly affect the power of the United States, we're talking about something terribly serious. Second, how do we organize our thinking about the threats to the United States? Very, very tough question. The issue of terrorism on the table, I don't think terrorism by itself is the answer. I think it's some combination of terrorism, proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, and failed states. And they're related. And I think that a lot of what we need to talk about here is how to address a foreign policy, national security policy to those concerns. And to me, if you make a judgment like that, and this is what strategy is all about, if you make a judgment like that, you then have to subordinate other considerations to meeting those concerns. For example, I mean, I want democracy in Russia too, but it's not going to happen soon. It just isn't. I want to see the Chinese reduce military spending, but it's not going to happen soon. And if we think that the real threats facing the United States over the next decade are terrorism, failed state proliferation of WMD, which I think they are, then we have to subordinate these other concerns, not to forget about them, but to subordinate them. They become longer-term issues.
Now I'm flashing the orange card. That's
okay. Orange card means only 5 minutes left. The last point is about when to use force and how you take the opinions of other states into account. I think you got to take them into account because, again, that's a practical matter. Steve Ann Everett made a terrific point, practical point, saying, hey, you can't do these things without taking account of nationalism and of dealing with it in your strategy. If you can't, boy, you better stay out. You have to take other nations' opinions into account, but you can't be guided by them. Look, however you feel about the Iraq war, the UN passed 1,000 resolutions saying that Saddam Hussein had to prove he didn't have weapons of mass destruction. Didn't say we had to prove it. Said he had to prove it. And, you know, we should have waited longer, let the inspectors play their thing out. But the fact of the matter is, after having voted for it, everybody said the hell with it. They said the hell with it. They passed two resolutions saying that Hezbollah in southern Lebanon should be disarmed, and then did nothing about it, leaving Israel into this situation where it has to use force in stupid ways to protect its security. They pass a convention on genocide and then do nothing about genocide. Nothing. Okay, I'm about to finish. So if you want to look to them, I wouldn't look to them for any moral standards whatsoever. I think to the extent they exist at all, though we flub them, they're with us. And we have to pay attention to them because it becomes a practical matter in needing support when and if we do decide to use force.
John Eikenberry. Thanks, Reed. And if people could just remember, we want to get everyone's views.
So I can have a few minutes.
Briefer rather than
so
longer.
Many debates, yeah, and I'd yeah, like yeah. To get into them. I'd like to talk about Wilson, but I won't. I'd like to talk about whether Bush is a break or not, and I maybe can get to that. But I wanted to raise the issue of the trajectory of U.S. power, which is responsive to Fareed's second question. This seems to me a critical assumption, making a judgment about that trajectory. If it's your view that there's something distinctive about the unipolar moment that makes it semi-permanent, that technology and American capacities of various hard and soft sort allow the United States to perpetuate this distribution of power, that would lead, it seemed to me, to a certain kind of foreign policy, not unlike, I think, the Bush administration doctrine, which did have, I think, if you read the West Point speech in 2002, this view that the U.S. really was going to have a semi-permanent position at the top of the hierarchy providing security above the rule of law, for the most part, and providing a public good, security, which would then require the rest of the world to, as he said, give up arms races and spend your money, including you, China, on other good things, but also allow the United States to stand back from some of the other rules and institutions that govern other countries. So that's one view, that there's something about preeminence that can be maintained, and it allows you a certain kind of horizon to make commitments. But if you think the wheel of power does turn, that the United States in relative position is going to decline over a 20, 30, 40-year period, then it seems to me you want to be asking, as I suggest in my paper, the kind of Rawlsian questions about what would you want to have in place today so that in 20 or 30 years, when you know you aren't going to be where you're at today, you aren't sure where you will be, but you know you'll be weaker in relative terms, what kind of system would you like to have in place? For me, that's the preeminent question of our time. That involves making investments, and I think investments mean institutions. And it also means thinking about Samantha's questions about collective action problems, which I think is the other big question. I liked her paper for highlighting this, that we have an undersupply of public goods. We have collective action problems that provide those undersupply or prevent the supply, the full supply. That entails American view, which gets to a critique of Bush, but it also entails free riding and the various ways in which other countries can shirk. So it seems to me that's the big issue. And I come back to bring this point home. Many people have argued that Japan, it was not just a decade of lost economic opportunity in the 1990s, but Japan had a decade of lost diplomatic opportunity because when it was still at the top in Asia and had the economy that was the envy of the world, it didn't do what now it looks like it should have done, to make peace with China, to establish a framework in the region, to get rid of the history issue so that when its position would be slightly overshadowed by a rising China, it would be in a position to be least worse off or the least damaged by that transition. I worry that we may be in the process of repeating what Japan experienced on a global scale. Do I have time for the second point?
Quickly.
Okay. This is the question of the break, and it seems to me in asking this question, we're asking the question, what went wrong? Was it Bush policy, or is there a fundamental shift in the structure that is going to make a serial failure of foreign policy? The honest answer is we don't know because we don't have more cases. We're going to have to let history run, and we're going to look back, and we play games about what would Gore have done. But it seems to me it's both, and there are deep shifts, and it would be a mistake for Democrats to think that they can simply do not Bush, and everything will turn right. And the deeper structure is what I call the Westphalian flip, that for 400 years we've had an international order where we've had it composed of a multiplicity of great powers, power diffused among these great powers, an equilibrium of power at the international level, and Weberian sovereignty at the state level. So great power, equilibrium, and Weberian states. And what we've seen in the last generation is an inversion of that, where the U.S. has a quasi-monopoly on the use of violence internationally, and we have eroded sovereignty. So as I tell my students, it's like a town that for 400 or 500 years has had multiple police districts and neighborhood watches, becoming a town that in a generation becomes one with one sheriff, and there are no locks on the doors. And that's a town that's going to worry about that sheriff no matter what political party he comes from, no matter what his doctrine is. There's a real problem of how do you have governance in a town where that power is of that sort, and you have these new issues, not the old post-World War II issues, because of eroded sovereignty, new issues of intervention, humanitarianism, terrorism, and so forth. So it seems to me that what Bush did is not recognize that shift and do all the wrong things and bring a kind of conservative discourse about international order, which earlier presidents in 1919 and 1945 and 1989 did not bring, that the liberal discourse that the U.S. brought to those earlier moments had to do with, yes, there is an international community. Yes, we need to build it. We need to adjust to it. Yes, international institutions are good for leveraging American power, and there's international legitimacy that we need to take account of. Now, Bush did not reject all three of those features of what I would call a liberal discourse on international order completely, but it shaded the other way. And that amplified the anxiety, the vibration that was already in the system based on this deep shift, this Westphalian shift. It made the vibration increase considerably. So I think the next president needs to have a policy that will take account of those shifts, and it leads us back to institutions.
David Kennedy, not to pick on him, but I mean, since it's an eloquent paper, very upset about the low bar for the use of force that the all-volunteer army has introduced. We had about 30 years, almost after World War II, without an all-volunteer army in which we fought massive, big interventions, taking close to 100,000 casualties, inflicting a million casualties, I don't know, in Korea and Vietnam. We then went to a volunteer army in, 72, 73, and we've taken, in the total 30 years plus years since, about 5,000 or 6,000, I think, military casualties and inflicted many more than that, but not the numbers of Korea and Vietnam. I mean, it's just an empirical fact. So, if I could say, in your intervention in the conference, you were nostalgic for 1945. Well, 1945 was followed by Korea and then by Vietnam. So, I mean, there's two words that haven't been mentioned yet, which I don't think is an accident. Because if one wants to really condemn Bush and distance oneself from Bush and not engage in serious thinking about the world we are in and what has to be done, one goes back to a sanitized version of the post-45 settlement and forgets about these rather unpleasant things that happened. Or 1989, to take the third wonderful moment, which was followed 5 years later by the worst genocide in decades, et cetera. I won't even get into 45 being followed by 47 on the Indian subcontinent, or 49 with a communist revolution in China, which 20 years later killed tens of millions of people. I mean, we just need to be serious about the world, and when we throw around these historical analogies, and I do it as much as anyone, I like doing it, we need to be serious about what happened in these different eras. And therefore, my second and final point is we need to be serious about the world we're living in today. It's not, I mean, there's a kind of extremism, I would say, in the description of the reality we're facing that just doesn't correspond. I'd put it this way. If we had met here in 1999, before the horrible Bush administration came in and ruined everything, and predicted where would we be, or let's say even 97, where would we be 10 years later? Asia is about where it was and where it was expected to be, with better economic performance by China and actually India as big pluses. The security structure is basically the same. I would even say perhaps marginally stronger, in that Bush has strengthened their alliance with the democracies, with Japan and India. China, Taiwan is problematic. It was problematic in 1996 when Clinton sent the aircraft carrier there. No big change. NATO enlargement has come out about as well or as problematically as most people would have thought in the mid-late 90s. Basically, I think, a pretty good story, but, you know, some backsliding, which was to be expected. Latin America, one could get upset about Chavez, but net-net, the two big players, Brazil and Mexico, have turned out better, I would say, perhaps, than the consensus might have been at the height of the currency and economic crises of 97, 98. So basically, most of the world is about where it would have been, I think, where we would have expected it to have been. And for all the talk about we're unpopular or this or that, you know, if you had told us at the height of Vedrine complaining about the hyperpower in 1998 that we would have Sarkozy in France, Merkel in Germany, and Gordon Brown in Britain, we wouldn't have. I think most Democrats in the Clinton administration or Republicans in the new Bush administration wouldn't have been too upset by those democratically elected governments. So it comes down to the Middle East, and no one. And Afghanistan is a just intervention, and it's been could have been probably done a little better, but basically it's better than people would have expected, I would say, even in 2002, in terms of this is the place that famously is the graveyard of empires and rejects like a foreign, you know, antibodies with great vigor and all that. So basically we're talking about the Middle East. Most of the Middle East is the same as it was. Now, some of us would have liked a more aggressive form, actually, of action in the Middle East, because some of us think, and I agree with Bush on this, that the status quo ultimately is unsustainable, et cetera. But the truth is the House of Saud continues to run Saudi Arabia and has probably cracked down a little bit on its domestic sources of terror and its financing of it. Mubarak continues to run Egypt. Another Assad runs Syria. As I say, some of us on the aren't so happy, perhaps, about that, but it's hard to claim that it's wildly different. Is there more anti-Americanism? The polls suggest that the revealed preferences of the governments don't particularly reflect that, I would say. There's a subtle argument to be made, which Samantha alluded to, about whether the propping up of the authoritarian regimes is problematic from the point of view of public opinion there, but that's a problem we've had pre-Bush. So even if Iraq were judged to be a disaster, which I don't agree with, then I would be happy at some point to defend both the decision to intervene and to make the argument that we're better off having intervened, I still don't think one can make the case that net-net the whole Middle East is that transformed one way or the other. So the world we live in is about the world we should have expected to live in. If one had been more attentive, we were a little surprised, of course, by what was happening under the radar screen with radical Islam, with jihadist Islam. But now, looking back, no one can seriously argue that that didn't begin in 79 with the Iran, or begin, didn't begin to become very powerful in 79 with the Iranian revolution and the Saudi response to that, and then with other things that happened, Afghanistan somewhat inadvertently, et cetera. And these were all pre-2001. So I just think there's a kind of, I don't really think it makes sense to say that Iraq, therefore, the consequences of whatever Bush's mistakes have been are much less dire, and I'd say much less significant in a way than the general discourse here has suggested. And the general discourse here suggested that only because there's been this kind of false golden age that everyone gets to compare the current world to.
Well, you raised at least for me two really interesting questions that I think we should try and pursue if we may. One is, looking back on your 99-98 period, what is the break, if there was a break of some kind? And I would argue, I would continue to believe that things are somewhat different, but that I don't think Bush was the breaking point. 9/11 was the breaking point. That is to say, what 9/11 did was took America's unrivaled hegemony after the Cold War and completely broke any domestic constraint on the use of American force, unilateralism, anything like that. And I think
You may well be right that other people could have been in power. But what 9/11 did was it made it much more likely that an American president would have the ability to move in a certain direction without worrying about the message. So Iraq is inconceivable without 9/11, frankly. Because while you had people like you arguing for it beforehand, without 9/11, it was, let's be honest, it was a minority view. 9/11 changes the domestic constraint, at least. That would be my speculation. Which
that means that 9/11 tips the balance in favor of one intervention where we already had sanctions, no-fly zones, and a pretty big bombing campaign. And that's the extent of the huge flip to an interventionist, militaristic
foreign policy. No, that's what I want to raise. I want to raise the question of whether 9/11 in some ways had the effect of shifting American foreign policy because we got scared and we decided that we had to act fast, we had to act unilaterally. All these things we have done in the past, Bob is right. The question is, did it put us on steroids on those issues because we felt that waiting was too dangerous?
There would be more than one such intervention you could cite. Well, we know what a regime.
It's taken up a lot of energy.
No, I'm sorry. We know what a regime on steroids looks like and how it behaves. And it's kind of just ahistorical to say that the Bush administration has been wildly. You know, they tripled the size of the military. They tripled the defense budget. They interned 120,000 Americans. It just hasn't happened. You know, it's so ahistorical. I think to put it that way.
Well, I would respectfully suggest that had Iraq gone well, there were a number of people, my guess would be some in this room, who would have argued that we should then at that point have used military threats at the very least with other regimes, and that that has been derailed largely because of the catastrophic failure in Iraq, not out of any great sense of restraint or prudence. And in point of fact, we have raised the military budget by about $300 billion if you count Iraq and Afghanistan, which is about the next 20 countries spend on military budget. So in any event, my second point, when I really want to just raise these, is the Middle East. I agree with you, by the way. The wind is at our backs, by and large. I mean, I think that America is in an extraordinary position post-Cold War. It continues to be. I think Frank Fukuyama is more right than wrong in his legendary article, and continues to be. The question then becomes, why does the Middle East derail things so much? Edward Luttwak has an amusing piece in the current issue of Prospect magazine in which he says, why don't we just take the approach that many countries have always taken towards backward, festering, cancerous places, which is ignore them. Let them wallow in their own misery and defeat, and every now and then, they'll send some terrorists out, you lock up the terrorists. Is instability in the Middle East something that should properly be the central focus of American foreign policy, as it has become, as it takes up all the president's time, energy, and attention? So I just put those two thoughts out. Was 9/11 the revolution, and is the Middle East important? Les.
I find Bill's comments bizarre. Saying it's just the Middle East is like saying to Mrs. Lincoln, aside from the assassination, what did you think of the play? The Iraq is the issue in the world. It is the issue that is totally occupying our leadership. It's just not another thing. And by the way, everything's going great, but there's this thing in Iraq. Everything was going all right or bad, whatever. And then you have Iraq, and why is everybody making it a fuss?
Yeah. Well, why? Tell me what has changed, including elsewhere in the Middle East.
You can see empirically the effects of Iraq are to embolden Iran, a power that compared to the United States is a 10th-rate power, which all of a sudden has been turned into a major power in the area as a result of these policies you're praising. Iran went from a country with an economy the size of Connecticut, an armed force that doesn't compare to the United States, to one that is challenging us throughout the area. Now why? It's basically because of the mistakes of our foreign policy. They're capitalizing on it. It's not because of their power. So it's not just Iraq. Iraq is dominating almost everything else because of the profound strategic mistakes. And mind you, when push came to shove, I was for this war. And I think if it had been fought with any sense, we wouldn't have gotten into a lot of these problems. But you can't shove all that aside and say it's just another issue. Secondly,
Yes, there were instances of threats, and I think being on steroids about threats with regard to North Korea and Iran. In fact, it's hard to remember a month where Bush didn't say, we'll never tolerate, we'll never accept if they do X, Y, and Z. They always did X, Y, and Z, and boy, did he tolerate them. Here's a guy who made daily threats and then didn't carry them out and squandered American power in a way that somebody I know like you would be appalled to see a president make empty threats like that. And Bush did repeatedly. So we see this really dominating the landscape because these are the events that shape the opinions of other countries about the United States and what we're able to do across the board. So it's not just Iraq, not just the Middle East, not just empty threats. It's the effect of all that on the effectiveness of the United States.
It's the last word, but as long as it's 1 minute long.
It was clear there was a there was good reason to do that, but the power we moved against was precisely the power that dropped the bombs on Pearl Harbor. The difficulty with the Iraq situation is it seemed to be the inappropriate target. By the way, just because I am a softy, but I did support nobody asked me particularly, but I did support the Afghanistan response, believing like Neil it was perfectly appropriate. And I also supported Bush to the first Gulf War because it seemed to me something in a type of traditional way that you could justify. We just somehow misappropriated, I think, both our domestic reserves of indignation and tragedy against what was not the appropriate target. And we did it differently, too. Remember, doing
this
with...
Why was the first Gulf War appropriate traditional? Why was Saddam not contained? Was he going to invade Saudi Arabia?
Because you got the UN Security Council
on
board.
To me, it
was
I love his dark.
You had an international
force.
Korea
was fine. Vietnam was fine. The first Gulf War was fine. That's just normal business of a law-abiding superpower?
Yes.
And Iraq is distinguishable.
I mean, Korea was.
All right, on this happy note of agreement. On this happy note of agreement, we are going to.
Maybe there'll be something
the next
more
session.
To talk about too.